You're listening to The Recap, first broadcast on the 23rd of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Rylan and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily, and of course, The Ten. Coming up, Islamic State and Palmyra. We'll ask what it is that the Islamic State really wants with the conquest of the ancient city.
After taking the town which they have and systematically working through it as they did at Nineveh, Hatra and other sites with explosives and diggers which they have done as we know in Iraq, the road opens up to Damascus.
And the European Union is fighting over suggested migrant quotas. But what else can be done to help ease the burden of thousands of migrants landing on Europe's doorstep?
Most of the asylum seekers who arrive in Europe still move north, but they do so irregularly, often still using smugglers when they're in Europe. So the alternative of relocation would mean that relocation could take place in a more orderly fashion.
And on a lighter note, we'll hear a Eurovision roundup from our own resident Eurovision expert, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and we'll hear views on why countries should pay more attention to unpaid work that so often goes unrecognised and unrewarded.
I think we have assumed that because women done this work unpaid for so long, we just assumed that it was always be there and we didn't need to think about it in economic terms.
All that and much more over the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Ben Rylan. Let's start this week's edition of The Recap now in Hong Kong. The city's first LGBT workplace inclusion index has just been released. It's the first of its kind in Asia and measures the level of inclusion and equal opportunities for lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender employees. Out of the 35 companies participating in the ranking, only three are local to Hong Kong, with the others being massive multinationals. But the biggest surprise is the fact that the city's largest employer, Hong Kong's government, has not signed up to it. That's what Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief Aisha Spears had to say about the report in the beginning of this week.
Well, I think the big issue here is that, in a sense, Hong Kong plays a, you know, see no evil, speak no evil policy when it comes to LGBT rights. There are discrimination laws in place in Hong Kong, of course, that are part of the basic law, and the basic law is kind of what makes Hong Kong special. But LGBT situations are kind of ignored. So over the last couple of years, you've seen some pretty high-profile cases, one being a transgender lady who wanted to marry her boyfriend. She had to bring that to the High Court here. Just recently, we've seen a case, I mean about a week ago, of a same-sex couple from the UK. One of them had a job here in Hong Kong, the other wanted to come in on a spousal visa and was not granted this. They've been denied now twice. Hong Kong, there's great social tolerance on a day-to-day basis, but it's not somewhere where you're going to see a lot of proactive government support for LGBT rights.
So the lack of local companies really reflects the situation in the city.
Absolutely. And in a sense, it's even more clearly reflected in the fact that these three local companies who did participate in this survey don't want to be named. So I think that is a very clear indicator of where people here lie. I mean, it's a pretty conservative place in many respects. It's more religious than I think a lot of people would think it is. And it's a place which obviously is international. It's internationally focused. It needs to attract international business and international workers. So this is one of the arguments that was made last week about this same-sex couple. Would it put off future expats who wouldn't be able to bring over their same-sex married partner if this ruling went the wrong way? And it did go the wrong way, and people don't seem to be too worried about it. As we can see in this survey, the top 10 are all international companies. Well, one of them is actually the British consulate, the British Council here. So the rest are big banks, and those are companies which frequently face problems here when they're recruiting expats who are in same-sex partnerships or marriages, who want to bring across their partners, who want to be able to get health insurance and a visa for them. These companies often face troubles and have to work around it.
How much was this publicised beforehand, and how much media attention is the index getting in Hong Kong now?
It's getting a little bit of attention through the LGBT community. I mean, it's not prevalent in the sense that you would, in many ways, that you would perhaps expect it to be in a large global city, but that it is strong and it's quite united here. It's not getting a huge amount of press, to be honest. It's perhaps because it's an issue which a lot of people either don't think about, because there are all sorts of other identity and human rights issues that people are more worried about. We're talking about freedom of press, freedom of speech, even things like the rights of the migrant workers here. So there are all sorts of things that are on the table as Hong Kong works out its future with regards to human rights, and LGBT rights are amongst these, but not necessarily the forerunner.
Aisha Spears there, Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief, speaking to Georgina Godwin. That was a highlight from Tuesday's edition of The Globalist. Well, time now for a highlight from Tuesday's edition of The Briefing. That was the day when the first semi-final of the Eurovision Song Contest took place in Vienna. 16 countries competing for 10 places for the big final on Saturday. Ahead of the semi-final, Monocle's Eurovision expert Fernando Augusto Pacheco went through some of the highlights of the week.
My personal favourite song, which I have to admit, I don't think it's going to win, but it's typical Eurovision. There's a dance track. It's something that you would love to hear on a loud gay nightclub,
in a
way.
And a big lady wearing not much.
Exactly. She looks like a Queen of Hearts from Alice in the Wonderland. Shall we listen to it? That's strong. That was from Serbia, Bojana Stamenov with Beauty Never Lies. I really like her, and I like her costumes as well. Finally, she's bringing some camp to this year's festival, which I was afraid it was becoming too boring, but you know. And it's interesting about Serbia, they were not in the Eurovision last year because of financial difficulties, so they are back.
Oh, it's nice to have them back. I did like her voice, even though I can't say I would have enjoyed that song that much yet, but maybe it's a grower.
Yeah, you should see the performance tonight.
The more I listen to it, the more I like it.
Shall we listen to a cool song? I think our listeners from Monaco 24 might like this one. It's from Belgium. The singer Loïc Notet, which is the finalist for The Voice Belgique last year. And the song's called Rhythm Inside. There's very modern beats, actually. Shall we listen to it?
And if we die tomorrow, what do we have to show?
So this Belgian entry kind of reminds me of the music I saw being played on MTV Music Television in 1999.
Which is a good thing. The 90s are back, Marcus. So, you know, it's always a good thing. And I have to say, he's only 19, by the way. So probably he was born 1 year after that.
Exactly.
So it's quite an interesting fact here.
We have one more song to talk about.
From Moldova, let's listen to the Moldova track and then we talk after.
Fernando, have we not had this song in the Eurovision already?
No, we didn't. That's Eduard Romaniuta with I Want Your Love. And I have to say, he's Ukrainian, so the Moldovans are stealing people from other countries. That's typical Eurovision as well. And the video clip's very interesting. He spent quite a lot of money. There's a lot of car chasing. We all like a car chase, don't we? And Moldova, again, they're like Finland. They like some offbeat choices. Even though this one is not so offbeat, it's very traditional, but I really enjoy it.
Great, and now you're going to be celebrating this evening when the first semi-final takes place in Vienna.
Well, it's work. I'll do research. It's not fun, Marcus, it's research.
That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco there, reviewing the acts of the first semi-final of this year's Eurovision Song Contest. You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted right here on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Well, first Britain, then France and Spain. Three of the Union's largest countries have all declared themselves out of Jean-Claude Juncker's migrant quota system. The system uses economies, employment rates and population to determine how many migrants each country should accept. And it's been championed by Italy, the migrants' main point of entry. But it's also been quite controversial, to say the least, since it was announced last week. So what does the future hold for this plan? And what else can be done to help ease the burden of thousands of migrants landing on Europe's doorstep? That's what Monocle's Georgina Godwin discussed with Don Flynn, director of the Migrants' Rights Network, and Catherine Costello, associate professor of international human rights and refugee law at Oxford University's Refugee Studies Centre. That was on Thursday's edition of The Globalist.
It's 20,000 people across all of the member states of the European Union was the original intention. And they had a formula for being able to allocate these based upon the size of each country and the presence of refugee populations already there, GDP and things of this sort. And it was thought that the UK in this instance was probably going to take something like 15% of this total. So that would have been something in the region of 3,000 people was intended to come to the UK. And with France and Spain being roughly approximate, then we can presume that between them, those three countries would have taken in the region of about 45% of the total amount.
Now, even if those countries were willing to do that, those numbers seem ridiculously small, 20,000. What percentage of migrants who actually need help would have been covered by that?
Well, it was just an absolutely tiny, tiny proportion. You know, these are refugees which have been accumulating in pressure points across the southern Mediterranean in places like Malta and in Sicily and other parts of southern Italy. It's very much, you know, a sort of a evolved response of releasing the pressure on a cauldron that's building up. And I think probably it was simply a basic test of European solidarity in this issue. Was there even a minimum amount that could be done of coordinated action between an array of European states which would encourage a belief that there really was solidarity between the European countries in order to deal with this issue? And what we're finding out is that even that minimum amount of solidarity probably doesn't exist.
Mm. But Catherine, let's look at how the legislation would work then in order to reach those quotas and what it might have to be changed to now.
Yeah, I think this has been so widely misrepresented because the proposal for a quota was in relation to relocating people who've actually claimed asylum in the EU. And we already have quite an onerous mechanism called the Dublin system that allows states to transfer asylum seekers. It costs them a lot of money. It tends to look normal because it allows, say, the UK to deport somebody back to Germany or Italy. But it still is a very costly, complicated mechanism. And we were going to try to replace this on an emergency basis as a provisional measure to have some relocation, particularly from Italy, which has seen 143% rise in the number of asylum seekers claiming asylum in Italy, partly as a result of the fact that Italy has been doing this very extensive rescue at sea operation, or had been doing until relatively recently. So this has been misrepresented. It's one, it's not about migrants, and two, it's on a provisional basis as a way to obviate some of the unfairness of the system that is in place, which is called the Dublin system. And so it's an emergency measure, and it's not about migrants, it's about asylum seekers. And then, as Don mentioned, there was also a proposal to resettle refugees, people who are in, say, the region of Syria, the millions of Syrians who are in countries like Lebanon, where you have 25% of the population now being refugees. I mean, it's been misrepresented.
One objection to this Europe-wide plan seems to be that many of these countries, Britain included, are already taking in asylum seekers and feel that they just can't take any more.
Well, can't take in any more, I think, just belies the fact that what we do have is extremely unequal distribution, with countries like Sweden and Germany taking far more than the others, however you calculate the amount, whether you take it just in overall figures or if you weight it according to population and GDP. So most of the asylum seekers who arrive in Europe still move north, but they do so irregularly, often still using smugglers when they're in Europe. So the alternative of relocation would mean that relocation could take place in a more orderly fashion. So, you know, naturally governments will say we take too many. But I mean, if you look at the figures, the distribution is highly unequal. And the UK is somewhere in the middle or the lower end of states in terms of accommodating asylum seekers.
That was Don Flynn there, director of the Migrants' Rights Network, and Catherine Costello, associate professor of international human rights and refugee law at Oxford University's Refugee Studies Centre. They were speaking to Monocle's Georgina Godwin on Thursday's edition of The Globalist. This is the recap on Monocle 24. After this short break, we'll hear about what the Islamic State really wants with the conquest of the ancient city of Palmyra. And we'll check in with Monocle's Robert Bound, who's mulling over a very important decision facing the British public.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland. Well, time now for a highlight from Thursday's edition of The Monocle Daily. Well, on Thursday, the Islamic State's conquest of the Syrian city of Palmyra appeared more or less complete. That was obviously a terrifying disaster for Palmyra's people, but it's also a potential tragedy for the world. On past form, the Islamic State doesn't really prove sympathetic to custodians of Palmyra's 2nd century Roman ruins. The Islamic State have previously made a point of destroying whatever pre-Islamic art and architecture that they've captured. It would be surprising if Palmyra's World Heritage listed status deters them. But what do they really want from Palmyra? That was the question Monocle's Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson asked from Berzine Wagmar from the London Middle Eastern Institute and the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, right here in London.
It is bang in the middle of south central Syria, and the road westward ho as the crow flies is to Damascus. After destroying, and I fear they will tackle the museum first things first, because therein you have artifacts which are large and fragile which could not be saved, according to Syria's antiquities chief, who says other things have been spirited out to safety, but not everything can be possibly done. And the museum is an open target, to say nothing of the ruins, the agora, senate house, the temple to the local Palmyran deity Baal, which of course is decidedly pagan and abhorrent to their so-called Sunni fanatical sensibilities. So after taking the town which they have and systematically working through it as they did at Nineveh, Hatra and other sites with explosives and diggers, which they have done as we know in Iraq, the road opens up to Damascus. Bang outside Palmyra are two gas stations, both of which facilities which provide electricity to Western Syria, including Damascus. And what will happen? Well, just like the Eastern Syrian refineries from which Assad is buying oil at depressed prices, courtesy ISIS, which is selling it to him, this will set in another sordid pattern where they will sell electricity to the regime too through these gas facilities as well, because they've captured it. It's as good as done.
We've seen Ramadi fall, now we've seen Palmyra. Where on earth is the US-led coalition and the Iraqi and the Syrian authorities?
Pathetically nowhere, in the fact that 40,000 Ramadians, as it were, Sunnis, have made their way into Baghdad, and the central authority in Baghdad are, well, just about taking them in. And just like we have had in Europe a scare, they feel some ISIS terrorist cells would have come into the city, capital city too. But also putting that aside, we know Lavrov and Kerry had talks in Sochi, the Black Sea resort, over 15th and 16th May. And now they're comes to an idea, a general idea has come about, however nebulous and early days, that we have to look at a post-Bashar scenario, and he would either be in Tehran or Moscow. But yes, there have been talks between Lavrov and Kerry, as I reiterate, and London is on the same page, as it were, as to what will happen. But it's very early days, so I wouldn't want to conjecture on that. It wouldn't be an educated conjecture at this point.
I guess we should, for the moment, attempt to remain optimistic and hopeful about the fate of the World Heritage Site at Palmyra, although, as you correctly point out, if one is betting with form, it very possibly isn't long for this world. But you mentioned there, you made a reference to their fanatical Sunni sensibilities. As far as it's possible to tell, judging on Islamic State's own actions and own rhetoric, what is the reason for this determined iconoclasm of theirs? Is there any genuine religious piety underpinning it, or are they just doing it because they are violent nihilist barbarians?
Violent nihilist barbarians, spot on. But also there is that, shall we say, Calvinist streak to not Salafists, but the Wahhabi puritanical streak to them, which is what Saudi Arabia does to so-called Ottoman structures in and around Mecca and Medina, as we know. They've been raised for these garish malls and high-rise apartments progressively over the years. And so it's all of a piece with that fetid thinking. And plus, they are deep down iconoclastic, so they feel they are doing God's work, literally.
There is also the human cost of this. Palmyra had become a place of refuge for lots of people, as indeed Ramadi had last week, that those who had been pushed out of their homes by IS were now finding this a comparatively safe place. But the newspaper headlines have been dominated by the potential damage to absolute sites of heritage importance. To what degree is this now a humanitarian disaster?
As it was reported once, these Arab problems, not just Syria, are creating about 10,000 refugees a day. This was carried in the Times last week, where I read about. And it's no exaggeration to say that it will get worse and worse. I mean, if the road, without sounding overtly sensationalist or a Cassandra, if the road is open to Damascus, what will finally entail is for Assad and the Alawites is their last strong foothold in the province around Latakia, which hugs the Mediterranean littoral, which is the traditional cradle of the Alawites, who are, of course, deemed even at the best of times as Shia heretics.
That was Berzin Wagmar there from SOAS, speaking to Monocle's Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. You're listening to The Recap right here on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Rylan. Now, anybody who has ever tried to understand anything about economics knows the name of Adam Smith. Indeed, anyone who has ever spent an English £20 note has seen his picture. Smith was the Scottish economist and philosopher who proposed the idea of economic man, a rational, benignly self-interested creature whose mutually profitable interactions with others of his sort would increase wealth for all. Well, a new book now by Swedish writer Katrin Markal suggests that there might be more to our economy than that. Entitled Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner? It makes the case that much valuable and unpaid work, undertaken in no expectation of compensation, goes unrecognised and unrewarded. Katrin Markal joined Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson in Midori House in Studio One this week, and here's a highlight.
Economics is a language that we take so seriously in society. There's all these books, Free Economics, Discover Your Inner Economist, etc., etc., etc. So it's a very, very powerful narrative, this narrative about economic man. And, you know, from Adam Smith and these ideas about economic man and rationality, there's this idea of the invisible hand that keeps the economy together. And, you know, my book is about the other side of it, the invisible heart, you know, care work, and how that work has been excluded and why it matters. I think economics is also almost an existential story. It's so powerful today. So this idea about self-interested, rational people is almost like the dominating religion of our time, and we need to think about it.
It is self-evidently the case that the kind of work you're talking about, from cooking dinner for Scottish philosophers downwards, is important, and it is economically important. Why isn't there a tradition of it being economically rewarded?
Well, I mean, economics is a very male subject and has, I mean, the story I tell in the beginning of the book is, so in The Wealth of Nations, which is the founding book of economics, Adam Smith asks the founding question of economics, which is, how do you get your dinner? And his answer is that we get our dinner because through the benevolence of the butcher, the baker, etc., the famous quote. So I just start the book by saying, but, you know, look at his life. He lived his whole life with his mother, and she probably had something to do with putting the dinner on the table. But that was something that he didn't think about. And economists since then have not thought of it. I think we have assumed that because women done this work unpaid for so long, we just assumed that it was always be there, and we didn't need to think about it in economic terms.
Have we thought about it a little bit more? I think there's a bit in your book where you talk about the idea of Keynesian theory coming through, and how Keynesian theory often talks about the irrational and the impulsive in the human being, the non-cool economic man. And yet after the great crash of 2008, everybody started to re-examine this all again. And the economic man, he found his foundations quite wobbly then, didn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, putting Keynesian economics to the side, yes, absolutely. Since the financial crisis, this sort of idea of this rational man, you know, it didn't work, right? You know, financial markets were not rational. So that the theory sort of fell. But what I want to add is the feminist perspective, because, you know, what I say in the book is that this character of economic man, who's always self-interested, always rational, doesn't have any feelings, any family or any context, really, all the characteristics that define him are the same characteristics that we have been taught for hundreds of years to see as male, right? And everything that's excluded from economic analysis, you know, the body, feelings, emotions, so on, are the same things that we have have been taught to see as female. You know, human beings, we are a lot more than economic man. And these things, I mean, you can see any experiment with sort of real people shows that, you know, the only people that actually in real experiments act this way are children under five. Everyone else will sort of take sort of feelings and other people into consideration. But I think because these things have been seen as female, they're also sort of valued less.
Swedish writer Katrin McCall there, speaking with Monocle's Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. Her book, Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner, is published by Portobello Books. Well, ticking towards the end of this edition of The Recap now, and to take us out, let's check in with a monologue. On Thursday's edition of The Globalist, we heard from our culture editor Robert Bound, whose mind was on a very important decision facing the British public.
In the next 5 years, the British people have a momentous decision to make. Sure, there's set to be a referendum on the UK's relationship with Europe that could change the fortune of every single subject in the kingdom and drastically change the future direction of one of the world's largest economies and the society that goes with it. But we're also going to get a hand in choosing the face that will grace the non-royal side of a new £20 note. And man alive, that will really unleash the political animals in us all. Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, made a speech at the V&A to get people's creative juices flowing recently. Why the V&A? Because whether they be a painter, a designer, a sculptor, or a film director, this note will star an artist. The rules are that they can't be living and they can't be fictional, if that's not a contradiction in terms. Dead and real then, but who? In his speech, Mark Carney urged the public to think beyond the most famous and the most obvious. Here are a few names that might fit the bill, both literally and metaphorically. Stanley Kubrick, David Lean, Barbara Hepworth, Amy Winehouse, J.M.W. Turner, Ian Dury, Francis Bacon, Charlie Chaplin, Lord Reith, John Lennon, Beatrix Potter, Lucian Freud, George Orwell, H.G. Wells, J.G. Ballard, John Peel, Ronnie Barker, J.R.R. Tolkien, David Abbott. There we have music, filmmaking, visual art, literature, comedy, broadcasting, advertising. The British are wonderful at them all. Are they all encompassed in the envelope of art that Mr. Carney was talking about? They'll have to, for the time being. I would love to see Amy Winehouse on a banknote more than I'd like to see John Lennon. Amy Winehouse, sadly metaphorical, like cash in hand itself, was there 1 minute, frittered away the next. And her image, a silhouette of beehive hair and heels, is on its way to becoming iconic. How do you choose between Charlie Chaplin and Stanley Kubrick? Both were complicated geniuses and impresarios about whom we're rightly proud. Is Chaplin's strange way with women enough to cancel out his might, invention and brilliance? Should currency be political and judgmental at all? Should we split our novelists into children's and adults? Can you choose a winner between Beatrix Potter and Tolkien and between Orwell and Wells as political writers? Would J.G. Ballard's dystopian ideas be welcomed as legal tender in your local pub? The titanic battle to be the best dead artist of the 20th century rages on between Freud and Bacon. Why not decide it on the piece of paper with which you pay for 8 minutes of parking around the Monocle HQ studios? My instinct is that a lady might win, and it looks good for Barbara Hepworth. And why not? Modern and modernist, Flintian charming, emollient and without the ego of many of her male competitors, Hepworth would be a popular choice and a wise one. But who cares for wisdom? I'd choose David Abbott, Britain's greatest advertising creative, who wrote, "I never read The Economist," Management Trainee 42, and others. After all, the dividing line between art and commerce is paper thin. As thin as what? You guessed it. For Monocle in London, I'm Robert Bound.
And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie and edited by Nathan Cooper. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs right here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Ben Ryland, thanks for listening. Enjoy your week.